Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. As always, Armin, how are you today? How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm really looking forward to talking about this topic. Yeah. I've been waiting for it for a while. Usually, usually when everybody is talking about a topic, we wait a little bit because if we talk about it too soon, by the time the podcast comes out, a few things have changed. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think like it's a good thing that we wait a little, but go on, Ali.
Well, what's funny is like what we're talking about today is we're talking about the Iraq election, right? That happened on October 10th. And, you know, even until now, right, the official results aren't really out yet. Is that right, Armin? I don't think they're out yet, right?
Well, no, I mean, they're out, but...
we know what happened, but...
No, but it's the Fatah people and the Iranian proxies who are so pissed about the results that they, like, recount and filing complaints left and right. They just cannot accept the results as part of reality. But so the results, like the recounts and the complaints are not going to change the result. What we're waiting on is to see. I can't wait to see based on these results what kind of coalitions are going to be built. And I was like, maybe by now we will have some results. And then I actually realized recently that this is going to take a while. And by a while, I mean a while. Like some people are talking March. Some people are talking June. Right?
Well, let's give the background of what we are talking about today, I guess, for those of you who haven't guessed already. So
you give the 101 of what happened.
Really quick and briefly so we can dive into it. So the Iraq held its this election on October 10th. It was supposed to be in June. It got delayed to October 10th. With the party of the Shiite populist cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, which many of you know, fought against the United States, the U.S. forces back in 2003. And since then, he's very, very, very opposed to foreign interference in Iraq's affair, not only from the U.S., but also from Iran. And that's going to be one of the most interesting parts of this that we're going to talk about. So he secured, I think, out of 300 and something seats, he secured 73 or 74 now at latest count from what I've seen. That's the largest number.
73. Seat. It's more than 70. It's crazy high. Unimaginably, no one predicting high. Mm-hmm. His coalition, his party has won. The Sadrist party has won. But yeah, go on. Sorry.
So the gains, like in 2018, right? I think his party had like 54 seats, and now they've moved it up to 73. Whereas the rival party, the Fatah party, right? Which has, I guess, it has a coalition with a lot of the pro-Iran parties. They lost. They just got like, I think, 16 seats or something. And they had more than that. Right?
They were destroyed.
Destroyed. Okay. But here's the interesting thing. The thing is the number of votes that they got is pretty similar. But the way that the system is, the election system is, this number of seats that the Sadrist party got is a lot more. And I think we'll also try to get into that and explain how that happened. Maybe not. I don't know. It's kind of boring. But the Southern Party, basically, they really knew the system well. They had a great ground operation and they played the system. They did it very strategically. The Fatah Party didn't. So So
people who don't know, the Sadrist Party, which is led by Muqtada al-Sadr, is a Shia party. Okay. And they used to be number one. And now they're more number one than they used to be number one. In 2018, they were still number one, but with above 50 seats. Now they're number one, but above 70 seats. The number two, which used to be the Fatah party, right, is now really down. And they were also Shia, but they were a Shia party loyal to the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think accurately you could look at them as a proxy of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the fact that they have lost so significantly has been seen as an outright no by the Iraqi people to the influence of Iran's on Iraqi policy. But I don't, here's the thing, I want to make sure that I don't make it, because I am, we are here so much into the geopolitics of the region, so we might overemphasize this, how much this whole election was about Iran's influence, and we have to be careful not to do that, because I want to, but again, you can't deny how big of an issue it was, but I do want to say that what this, set the stage by saying what this election was about, like beyond just the geopolitics in the region. Do you think that's a good way to start?
That's a good way to start, but let's talk a little bit. I think the interesting part of this about when it comes to the Iran angle is that going Iran is a
You got cut. Shit. Your microphone is a. You say it again. You got your microphone was saying.
Can you hear? Can you hear it?
Yeah. Just repeat what you said. Yeah.
Okay. What happened was that the Iran is like a majority Shia country. Iraq is a majority Shia country, about 62-63% Shia. But the Shia people in Iraq are now kind of split. There are some that are, you know, they have an alliance with Iran. Iran has had has its parties, like I think it's the PMF, right, in Iraq, that has been responsible fighting the Islamic State in Iraq, and that's a, as an Iranian popular, proxy.
Yeah, the Popular Mobilization Front.
Mobilization Front.
Hashdashabi. Yeah.
Right. So that's the pro-Iran parties, and the pro-Iran parties did not do very well. Now, Muqtada al-Sadr is kind of interesting because
that's not the name of the party. That's the name of the militia. So we have to put there's a politics and then there's a military force. There's a separate thing. You have the Iranian militia on the ground, which is the largely, not all, but largely controlled by Iranian proxies, which is the PMF. And then you have the politics. And actually, that's a very important thing to add here. Even though the Iranian influence in the parliament has been reduced dramatically, it doesn't mean that Iran doesn't have control, a lot of control over Iraq, because the militia aspect of that is still there. They're not going to be like, oh, okay, we're going to pack up and go home now. It's not like that. They're still there, and when it comes to military power, it's easier to reduce the role of Iran in the parliament. Again, not completely remove it, but reduce it. It's a much more difficult thing to reduce their military power right now that they have on the ground. But yeah.
Yeah, the militias figure pretty prominently in this too. I mean, that's a big sort of factor. And then the what's interesting about Muqtada al-Sadr, Armin, this is something I want to potentially learn from you about more, is that Muqtada al-Sadr is against Iranian interference, so he's not necessarily pro-Iran, but he does spend a lot of time in Iran, apparently. Apparently, like behind the scenes, he has a lot of,
these are a lot of details that we could get into. I think like we need to get to the 101 out of the way. Yeah, he exiled himself in Iran for a while, but now he's becoming Iran's greatest nightmare in Iraq. But I think those are a lot of interesting details. I do think that there are some really, I don't even know if I could get through all the things I want to get to today. So I do think I need to cover.
Okay, let's start. Let's go with the 101.
Okay, so the election, the main, if I want to give an overall, first of all, the main issues that people, the Iraqi people seem to have had, I don't want to speak for the Iraqi people, but this is based on all the analysis that shows, right? So it's like the lack of public services, right? Iraqi people are frustrated with that. We're talking really basic public services like water and electricity. After 20 years of experimenting with democracy, the fact that these are still issues is like the Iraqi people have lost patience, right? Another thing that we want to highlight is that the extreme, I have my list here, I just want to make sure that I don't get this wrong, because we're not Iraqi and we're speaking for them. So I just listen to a lot of Iraqi interviews on the ground and also polls and a lot of other analysis to make sure I don't get this wrong. Okay.
Yeah.
The corruption level is astronomical. Like we have corruption in some countries, and then we have Iraqi corruption. Like the billions of dollars, like the hundreds of billions of dollars that have just been smuggled out of Iraq. Like this is not a country that could afford this level of corruption. Like this is like a crazy a lot of money. Like also, like I think the figure I had somewhere was like 150. I couldn't believe this. This is because based on Iraqi economy, the fact that 150 billion, this is the estimate, Ali, $150 billion alone were smuggled out of the Iraq since the U.S. invasion. Okay, I mean, if you're an American, you might think this is like not pocket change, but this is it, just from corruption. This is a major amount of money. Okay, like we have MPs that has came out that their income was $20,000 a month. Okay, $20,000 a month in Iraq for being an MP. This is like high level corruption, and a lot of this corruption is because of Iran's involvement, Iranian proxies. And this brings us to the third factor, foreign involvement. Okay, the foreign involvement in Iraq has been a major issue. This used to be U.S. involvement, but right now it's mostly about Iranian involvement. Okay, Muqtadir al-Sadr himself used to be somebody that was mostly known for opposing the U.S. Okay, now Muqtadir al-Sadr has become U.S.'s asset in Iraq because he's pushing back against Iran. Muqtadir al-Sadr, remember, like when we first he became famous. I mean, other than the fact that he's the son of his father, but other than that, because he was like a great marja, his father, right? But that aside, he himself is famously known for the Mehdi army after the fall of Saddam, which was a major resistance army against Americans.
The U.S. occupation, yeah.
Yeah, this guy's army killed Americans, killed American soldiers. But now Americans are so happy that he's winning, even though they used to be mortal enemies, because now his main opposition is not... I mean, it makes sense for your main opposition not to be against Americans, because Americans themselves seem to be like leaving slowly. Like, why? Like, there's not that much of a push for Americans leaving because they seem to be wanting to leave themselves. In fact, Muqtadir al-Sadr spent his speech suggesting that he is for American, indirectly suggesting that everybody should have an embassy here, like suggesting that he would not be like as extreme anti-American as a lot of people thought. And then by suggesting that all embassies need to be present and all we need to have relationship, he mentioned America without mentioning America, but he also mentioned Iran without mentioning Iran directly.
Sorry.
Oh, are you? Okay. He mentioned Iran without mentioning Iran directly by saying that foreign forces shouldn't be determining our politics. He was definitely talking about Iran, especially because he said that all arms, all militia, army activity should be within the government's control. And that was like basically a diss at all these proxies that were kind of working independently from the official army that the government had. I mean, Muqtadir al-Sadr might say that. I mean, that's inch for him. It's just like, I mean, it seems very hopeful for him to be like, oh, yeah, great. He's going to get rid of the militia. That is not possible. I mean, it's great for him to say that. I mean, it's very a move in the right direction. But again, it's one thing to say, like, how are you going to kick them out? With what army? They are extremely powerful, yeah, right?
He said that the only militia there's going to be is the militia of the state, right? The soul of the state.
He said all arms should be controlled and maintained by the official army of the government, the state, right. Not by all of these... Which is like kind of hypocritical because he also is in charge of the Mehdi army.
He has a huge army of his own, right? So
yeah, but I mean, maybe he is the only. So here's the thing: there is maybe it seems hypocritical, but it also makes sense for him to be the only one that could make a major push against this because he would, you know what I mean, against the Iranian influence. Like, there's no outside force that could reduce Iranian influence. If there's any chance for reducing Iranian influence in Iraq, would be from a homegrown powerful figure like Muqtadir al-Sadr, right? Like this is why this is such a guys. I know this is like mainly very interesting to me because of my interest in Iranian politics, but so maybe I don't want to come off as exaggerating this, but I can't emphasize enough of how major of a defeat this is for the Islamic Republic of Iran. Again, I'm not suggesting that they're losing all their influence in Iraq, and far from it, but they have invested so much in Iraq to make it a second Lebanon, right? Like this success that Iran had with Lebanon after the revolution in making dominating Lebanese politics in such a degree, both militia-wise with his, like, basically Fatah, the Fatah party in Iraq is supposed to be like Hezbollah in Lebanon, to be well, part of Hezbollah, in, because Hezbollah has managed to do both the militias, both the in Lebanon are controlled by Hezbollah, and the parliament, okay, in Lebanon are controlled by Hezbollah, and the Hezbollah is basically Iran's proxy. But it, being able to do this in Iraq would have been, it was so, like, Iran, Iran's government has spent so much in being able to control Iraq against the wishes of the Iranian people, has paid such a huge political cost in Iran by making people upset about how much Iran's government is spending in other places. And to lose all this control after paying such a high cost for it, is something that Iran's government is not going to be able to tolerate, okay? And they have said so much themselves. Like, they have came out publicly said that this is, we're not going to accept this at any cost, at any cost. Like, they officially have said that there's no way they're going to accept the results of this election, and they're willing to pay any cost for it. What was the official thing that he said?
I mean, they're threatening violence, right? I mean, indirectly, yeah, and directly. I mean, that's what they're saying. They said that we're going to have, yeah.
Wait, Amiri said something. I mean, they haven't said, okay, so they haven't said directly, like Amiri himself, which is the head of the Fatah party, hasn't said that they're going to do violence, but he has specifically said that they will pay whatever cost necessary to not have this result standing.
And they're militias, yeah, too, so.
Yeah, so
it's a veiled violent threat.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. So some good, I want to see tell you the good things that happened about the election, just like give you a list, and the bad things, okay? The good things was that this election was extremely peaceful and very organized, very orderly, and everything was counted for. International observers were there, both UN and mainly EU, and they were like, this was, if you could have any election that is like transparent and controlled and not corrupted and not peaceful, you know, completely peaceful, this was it. Like, this was really nicely done.
Right. No attacks, no violence, no nothing.
An EU stamp of approval of being completely legit, which makes these all stamps of international approvals makes the claim by the Fatah party that this is a fraud and we need recount. It's laughable. Like, this was the best kind of election you could have get, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one good thing. Another good thing, obviously, is the reduce of the Islamic Republics of Iran's influence in Iraqi politics. That's a good thing. Another good thing is that the act. So one thing that we should have said earlier is that the history behind this was okay. So let me actually just tell you what the good thing is, and then give you the history. Is that the activists, the protesters that came to the street, even though a lot of them were trying to boycott this election, the ones that didn't boycott their election managed to get a new party in with, I think, 10 seats, if I remember correctly, which was insane that a new party that just came out of these protests managed to be able to get that much of a seat. I have to check how many seats they got, but I could check later. But that was insane. So that was a good thing. And basically, these protest movement, which called the Tashrin, it is referred to as the Tashrin, it has started since 2019. There has been a lot of protests in Iraq, especially about the things that I mentioned, the corruption, the lack of public services, and foreign influence. You have to understand that Iraq has a very young population. I think if I remember correctly, more than half of the population is under 25, and they have become very upset about the way, I mean, 25, like a lot of these people that are involved in politics, a lot of them don't even never even experienced Saddam or remember Saddam, which is crazy, right? Yeah. But the thing is that this they have had a huge influence on politics in Iraq, which is kind of amazing, because you have to understand. So here, let me make this clear. Okay, since 2019, we had a lot of protesters coming into the street, and the youth, the Tashrin movement, the Tashrin like protest movement, had managed to get the previous prime minister to resign. Okay, the Abdul Mahdi guy, right? And then we had this Kazemi guy, or as the English version is Khademi guy, He came in power. A lot of Iranians consider this this new prime minister to be a puppet of Americans. But he's been very good because he came into power promising the protesters that he's going to have early elections, right? So he came into power in 2020 with the intention of having early elections and with the intentions of having electoral reforms. And he kept those two promises.
He did
these
it.
Elections that this election that we had was in response to the protesters' demand for election. So he gave them that, and he gave them electoral reform. So all these new parties that are not part of the establishment managed to come and compete. And again, we saw one of the parties that was a result of these protest movement managed to win. However, this was not good enough for most protesters because most of these Tashin people decided to boycott the election. And that's why this election had such low participation. An interesting thing, Ali, a lot of people say the participation was 41%, but it's not 41%.
36, right?
34%. Because they are tricking you. They used to count participation as a percentage of the people who are eligible, but now they're counting it as a percentage of the people who registered. So people are like, oh my God, this is the lowest turnout. It's 41%. It's actually lower. It's 35. It's lower. One third of the people, like, this is the lowest participation since the US invasion. So most of the protesters were saying a big no to the election as well. They don't want a reform. They say no to reform. They wanted to a complete undoing of all the big establishment parties, which is kind of actually unrealistic. It's impossible to get rid of these people. But the protesters who did want to participate in elections, they now have something to show for, because they look, even with the boycott, we managed to get a new party that just because of the electoral reforms, these new parties were able to participate. They managed to get this many seats. And they're like, imagine if we had participated, we would have like become so much more competitive compared to these giant parties, right? The establishment parties. So now a lot of the protesters that didn't participate, they're not like, so a lot, some people are suggesting that between the youth Tashrin protesters, there seems to be a conflict. The people that wanted to participate and the ones that didn't participate. But a lot of people are saying it's not really a conflict. It's just like a brotherly or sisterly disagreement. And now the ones that were saying that they didn't participate, I think they're sending out a message that we'll watch you, the ones that participated and now got this party. We'll decide in the next, I don't know, 4 or whatever years, see what you do to see if like participation is a better way or complete. Like, but go ahead, you want to.
Yeah, but I was going to ask you something. Wasn't there the threats to boycott by like pretty much everybody? And the Muqtada al-Sadr's party also threatened to, I think in July they said they would boycott, and then they maintained that. And then in August they came back in.
Yeah. And this, okay. So here's the thing. This has, yeah. And he managed to, the fact that everybody else so many people were boycotting was such a beautiful opportunity for al-Sadr to come in, because al-Sadr doesn't have people that really follow him. He has just like, no, I have to don't say that. Okay, he has people that just follow whatever he says, right? Yeah. Like, they're like, tell us what to do, Muqtada al-Sadr. So when he says, like, so when so many, this is why he got so many seats, right? Because when so many people were boycotting, and then he last minute, 1 month before the elections come, like, everybody save the country, go vote. And all his supporters go like, oh, he said vote, go vote, and they go vote. Obviously, when other people are boycotting, he managed to get so many seats, right?
So
that was a very clever move. He did. He just played like a 4D chess with everybody. But here's another thing.
I want to say one other thing that was really clever is how strategic he was by exploiting the law. So the old election law, right, in Iraq basically meant that if there are two people from a party, and supposing one of the candidates in the same region gets 10,000 votes, then this and they both need, and there's two people, then the extra 5,000, they'd be distributed to both of the candidates from the same party, right? And then now they change that rule so that each person, there end up being more wasted votes, and you get one person who keeps all the votes. So Sadr actually understood that system. Fatah and all these other parties, they didn't understand it. So even though Fatah got actually a few more votes, the absolute number of votes more than Sadr's party, they won a dismally low amount of seats, whereas Souther was able to convince his voters because his voters would do anything he says. So, you know, we went and told him, he's like, go, you know, this many of you vote for this candidate, this many of you vote for this candidate, so they can have an equal distribution. And then that's how he ended up getting a lot of seats. So he was clever in many, many ways, like even just when it comes to the new electoral process. He was clever in that way as well.
So just to be clear, he hasn't become more popular, okay? Because he didn't get more votes this election. Yeah. He got more a more share of the votes, but he didn't get more votes compared to before, right? There's a huge discontent. There's a huge lack of interest in the established political party. A lot of people were tired of all the politicians. So nobody is getting more popular, except maybe this whole activist Tashreen party that just came out, okay? So another good thing I want to mention, though, is that this is an indication, because the greatest force, the greatest united force in Iraq, outside of politics that influences politics in Iraq, has always been, until now, the Majaya, right? The Majaya Taqli, the guardians. I don't know how do you translate that. Ali, you know what I'm referring to in Shia Islam.
They're like the mujtahids, right? These are the people who are at the highest level of.
So what I'm saying is that in Shia Islam, you have this concept of you just following on question, you know, the people, a certain jurists or certain religious figures, and you just do what they say. A lot of Sunnis criticize Shias for just doing that, and this is like, listening to Sistani, for example, or listening to Khamenei, or listening to Muqtada al-Sadr and just following his command, is a very, very Shia thing to do, okay? It's kind of like the Pope in Catholic tradition, right? I mean, more before than now. But this, so listening to what the Marja say and just doing what they're saying, it's a very powerful force outside of politics that influences politics in Iraq. But the good thing is that we're seeing now this whole Tashreen movement, this whole youth protest movement, has now become so influential in Iraqi politics that it has challenged the Majaya. So if you just look at the number of seats, you might say, like, well, that's not true, Armin. You can see that the Muqtada al-Sadr, which is a religious preacher kind of guy, you know, he himself is not like an Ayatollah, but he is still seen as like a marjab for a lot of people. Not officially, but, you know, technically he is. He told people to come and vote, and he has so many seats. So how could you say the role of Marjaya is being reduced? Well, the thing is that, you know, more than 70% of the people didn't vote. Okay. And that is if you only look at the number of people who vote, it seems like the Marjaya influences is growing, right? But if you look at the number of people as a whole, it was the Tashreen movement that was boycotting the election. They technically did vote by not voting. So you have a major contender to the source of this whole religious influence. And, you know, the politics is moving beyond Shia versus Sunni, Kurd versus Arab, right? If you look at these youth movements, they're like, we want a functioning government. Thank you very much. You know what I mean? Like, this is like, I'm trying to, among all of this nonsense, because try to put a positive spin on all of this, right? Mm-hmm. Because I know this is not going to resolve things, the corruption or the basic needs that the Iraqi have for a very long time. But it's encouraging to see that the demand, the nature of the demands of a lot of the protesters in Iraq, when the new generation compared to the old one, is not these ideological or ethnic issues. It's like what their demands are more about ending corruption, ending foreign influence, and, you know, providing basic services, having a functioning government. These are the demands people should have, and it's moving in that direction. And we kind of do need to see these demands like this, because, I mean, like, if you keep looking at countries like Pakistan, makes you like make you think like everything is going in the wrong direction. But I think it is good to see, like, focus on some places like Iran, Iraq, and see, like, maybe things are not going to be resolved in the short term, but maybe the new generation, once they all completely come into power at some point, things are going to be moving in a better direction. So the bad things that you could say about this election was the fact that the turnout was low. I mean, some people see it as a good thing. Some people see it as a bad thing. Another thing is that even though Muqtada al-Sadr party won, and it's a good thing that he has like this whole anti-Islamic Republic attitude, but we'll see. Muqtada al-Sadr, by the way, has switched his position on things quite rapidly, so we don't know where is he going to be at in 4 years from now, what he's going to say, right? But the thing is that he's not going to be able to completely control what decisions are going to be made. Like he has to make a coalition. And right now, for example, the Fatah party has been defeated, but they just, a week ago or two before, they came out and said like, okay, yes, we have only 17 seats, but we managed to unite with this party and this party and this party, and now we have 73 seats, right? So what we are going to see is like, because there, it's not going to be, we're going to see, is it going to be Shias uniting with each other? Because if you don't understand Iraqi politics, you might think like, okay, Shias are going to get together and build a coalition, and the Sunnis are going to get together and they're going to build a coalition, and then the Kurds are going to build a coalition. But that's not the way it works. The Shia parties are more afraid of each other than they're afraid of the influence of the Kurds and the Sunnis, right? So they would rather unite with other parties to make sure the Shia party that seems to be having the upper hand not have the upper hand, right? They don't. You understand what I'm saying? So the Fatah party is trying to show that they are able to unite with enough parties to match the 73 seats of the Sadr party. But the Sadr party is like, I already have another 10 seats with this other guy. So even if you have 37 seats. So, by the way, Assad party.
It's a battle of coalitions. Like,
But the Assad party doesn't just want to be able to build a coalition. They want a majority government. That's what they really want. Yeah. Okay. And another thing that the Shia party, the Fatah party, is trying to do, and the Maliki as well, is that to make the Sunnis and the Kurds unite with each other to force Assad to work with the other Shias as well. Like, look, the Sunnis are uniting. Maybe the Shias should be united. But the thing is that al-Sadr, at least with his initial speech, he seemed to be suggesting that he's going to unite with the non-Fatah, close to Iranian parties as a way to sideline them. But these other Shia parties are like, you can't do that. You don't get to do that to us. So they're trying to force us ahead. So, by the way, I'm just trying to say that this whole, it's not as easy. Like, this is going to be a fight that is going to be happening. Like, the coalition that is going to be built is not that simple. We don't know where this is going to land. And the fact that the Fatah party has access to all these Iranian-backed militia that they could stir crap up if they don't get their way, that's going to be on the back of the mind. I mean, this is really scary, because at some point, al-Sadr wants to avoid like a civil war, right? Like, they don't want to have armed conflict back in the streets and everything. Mm. Oh, and when I was talking about corruption, I had to mention something that the Iranian proxies did. Okay, so Ali, like, one thing that made these Iranian proxies and also the party in government very, very unpopular is that when all of these protests were happening and the journalists who were covering it, the Iranian-backed parties, they would assassinate them, kidnap them. There were really heavy consequences for, like, Iran's influence in Iraq is really aggressive. It's very violent. Like, they are so interested in eliminating their opposition that they have done, but this has backfired. Like, people, I think al-Sadr himself had, like, came out and said, like, the people who are taking part in assassinations and kidnapping, these are like, they should not be part of the government. So Iran's proxies were trying to all of these protest movements, fight them by like intimidating them, but it backfired in the elections because people are like, whoever is responsible, like, they said a big no to all this Iranian influence by so if Iran wanted to win using this strategy, they actually lost so much using the strategy. But go on, I haven't let you spoke for a while, sorry.
No, that's fine. I actually wanted to ask you another aspect of this that I'm curious about. Is and that's the U.S.'s position. I mean, do you have anything else to say before we go on to that? Or
I have so much to say, but so I don't know. Okay, so well, the U.S. is
Well, I mean, I had a question, right? So, the way that I'm seeing it is that okay, so the U.S. right now, when Southern's party wins, right? Southern won U.S. I think whether there are 2,500 troops left in Iraq right now. And they're there to battle like the last part of the whole purpose right now. The reason they're staying there is to battle the Islamic State. Okay, the remnants of it. The Islamic State has been pretty much obliterated for the most part. And Muqtada al-Sadr is not going to have the, he's not going to want the 2,500 U.S. troops there. So on the one hand, there's a concern that if they withdraw those...
They're still there, though. Like, they could,
they're still there.
Yeah, okay. And they could grow, but go on, yeah.
They could grow, but the thing is, on the one hand, well, this is a question of what the U.S. should do, what their strategy should be, because we know that the U.S. is now trying to disengage from everywhere in the region, right? They're trying to bring everybody back. So on the one hand, if they remove all their troops, then they leave Iraq in the hands of Iran. I mean, that's one of the concerns that they have, which may not be as big a concern now as it used to be. And on the other hand, get out of there because like they don't really have to Islamic State anymore, so they can disengage and they can continue that whole policy of disengage. So which side do you think
United States is very concerned about Iran's influence? Like, this is a major concern for United States and Israel, right? Like, mm-hmm. you have to understand, like, this is, you know, Iran's influence, being able to go from all the way to Iraq to, you know, and Lebanon and Syria, all the way to the borders of Israel, and having Iraq as this safe haven where it could keep growing its militias and building a place where it builds armies, where it could then mobilize to all the places in the region. That is like a very destabilizing factor, and something that not for United States, but for Iraqi people. Like, the Iraqi people are having their country turned into a chessboard between other powers in the region. Like, their country is being used both monetarily and in military ways as a proxy for other governments that they haven't elected for their interests, for their geopolitical interests, which is insane, right? And United States can't just, like, based on its calculation, it can't, if it just washes its hands off of that and just leaves Iraq, which is forced to do so, it will, what will happen is just, like, just leave the field for Iran, right? So that's why they have openly shown, have declared that they're happy with the results of this election, which is very interesting, but, like, so ironic, where their main enemy in Iraq has won and United States has approved it. And al-Assad is kind of also... Yeah, so
former, like, enemy.
Yeah, former. Yeah, I mean, maybe future enemy as well. We'll see. But here's the. I don't think I'm in a position to make. I honestly think, like, getting Saudi Arabia and China involved in Iraq is very good stabilizing. I think how, like, so? The fact. Well, so, okay, so Iraq is becoming, instead of Iraq becoming a major battlefield between different powers, outside powers, Iraq has recently shown to become a major negotiating table instead for different powers, right? So Iraq wants to become like the role Qatar plays, for example, when it comes to bringing people together. Like, I'm the peacemaker between enemies, you know what I mean? Like, kind of like what Russia wants tries to do, or Qatar tries to do. So, you know, I think, like, if Iraq manages to play that role more and more, it will become so valuable for too many. It will become, its peace and stability will become valuable enough for the powers that be, for more people to be interested in maintaining some peace there, right? So you could see, like, Iraq was becoming a place where it was potentially Saudis and Iranians were meeting to talk about maybe, like, not attacking each other so often, right? But also economically, because Iraq was also becoming used economically by Iran. But all of a sudden, opening, you see that Iraq is trying to counter that by negotiating and having better economic ties to not just Saudi Arabia, but other Gulf states and Egypt. And if they become more and more economically interested in Iraq, then when Iran wants to stir crap up in Iraq, it's not just the United States that is a force that is in front of them. It's also all these other powers that are like now are motivated in not letting Iran have an influence in Iraq. And also, if China could grow economically, see, this is like, as much as we attack China's human rights violation, I think China's economic investments in many countries is a good way to get, you know, a superpower to be motivated in stability, because the more you have economic interest in country, the more you will use whatever influence you have at maintaining some level of peace, right? So China also has a huge influence on Iran. China and Russia have more of an influence on Iran's decision than United States will ever, you know, will have. So if China becomes more interested and more involved in investments in Iraq, having Iran being a destabilizer in that region will make Iran's power play against Chinese interests, right? Again, I am very interested in seeing China grow. Like, I know a lot of people talk about Chinese debt trap and as well, but I honestly think growing investment, economic ties with China is a stabilizing influence everywhere, even in Africa, or also in Afghanistan, right? Economic interests always are the best way to maintain peace. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's the best way to maintain any kind of influence, right?
Yeah. Also, a number I had here that I forgot to mention, but is very important, is that more than 600 activists have been killed during the protests, okay, since 2019. And no accountability. Nobody has gotten in trouble for it. And it's with the understanding that it's mostly Iranian influence that is responsible for killing these activists, right? Nobody has gotten in trouble for this. Like, this, the most accountability you have gotten for as a result of these assassinations of activists has been the fact that they have lost seats in the parliament. So I just wanted to, and also this has completely undone the good faith that these groups involved, because what they had as a selling point to the Iraqi people was that we saved you from ISIS. Like, but the whole narrative of the PMF and the Iranian proxies was that if we didn't get involved, all the men would be now dead, or you would be ISIS wives right now, right? Or like slaves or something. Like, this all of Iraq would be ISIS right now. Okay. So that's their narrative, right? That United States has air support, Russia had air support, whatever. We gave you the boots on the ground. You could not have won against ISIS without the boots on the ground. So with this narrative, like, they were like, you have to give us all of Iraq now because we saved you. Like, you have to give us all the military, all the, you know, you owe us, right? They said like, oh, you came and saved us. Thank you. Are you going to leave now? Or like, no, this is our home now. What are you talking about? Right? They're like, oh, okay. But can you please let us learn our country? Like, nope. We're going to completely dominate. And they had this winning argument that we saved you, but now with all these, like, with all this, they lost, oh, the word that I was looking for is the goodwill. They lost all that goodwill with all these, like, they were like, okay, thank you for killing ISIS, but you're the terrorist now. So, yeah. Right? So that's the new narrative, right? Yes.
Oh, wow. You want to say? No. I was just saying, it's just like everything's so convoluted. It's not just convoluted when you look at a cross-sectional just view of it at a point in time, but it just changes so fast,
right? Like, but by the way, I also want to be clear, when I say are you going to go home now, I'm not talking about going home to Iran, okay? Mm-hmm. These are Iraqi citizens, okay? This is why the citizenship and loyalty to the Vilayat-e Faqih version of Shia Islam is kind of like a gray line, because when I say go home, I mean go home in your actual physical home and stop fighting, right? Like, yeah. Put your arms down. Like, there's no back to Iran. This is why the Iran's influence in Iraq is so much, because this is not like a foreign army inside Iraq. These are Iraqi citizens that are loyal to a non-Iraqi government.
No, it's like Hezbollah, like you said.
Yeah, that's why it's so hard to get rid. Like, okay, so here's the thing.
Like, Hezbollah is an Arab army that's fully loyal to Iran. Yeah.
Yeah, this is why it's harder to get rid of Iran's influence than American influence. Okay, you American soldiers, you know, you're like, go home. You could get them to go home. This is not your country. Okay, what are you gonna tell to Iranian militia, right? The Iranian militia, go home. You're like, I'm an Iraqi. This is my home. Like, how can you get rid of Iran's influence when you have Iraqi citizens that are willing to die for Khamenei? You know, this is not something you could just be like, hey, guys, can you leave our country? Like, it's hard to do that, right? It's harder to get rid of Iranian influence in Iraq. So that's okay. Another thing.
So yeah. So and one more question I had. Where is Ayatollah Sistani, the grand Ayatollah of Iraq, Ayatollah Sistani in all this?
Right. So Ayatollah Sistani, is hard for him to be as influential because his main influence on politics is not to influence politics.
True.
Right. So he's like a secularist, like he's a religious leader that who advocates for not having a religion involved in politics. Right. So so this is such a self-defeating. This is the problem with secularist religious leaders, okay? Because by the very nature of wanting to be not involved in politics, you will have less influence, right? So the main two grand sources of religious authority in Shia Islam is number one, Khamenei, who's the very opposite of a secularist. He owns a theocracy in Tehran, right? Mm-hmm. And the second one is being Sistani, okay? So by all accounts, Sistani should be more powerful when it comes to having influence, because he has the religious credentials. Khamenei's main, I think Khamenei has like a main confidence, self-worth problem, because he never actually got the religious credentials to be a grand Ayatollah, and he doesn't have the credentials to be the supreme leader in Iran. And that's why he was supposed to be like a temporary supreme leader, but somehow he managed to just stay on. And this is why he's constantly afraid of all the challenges to his religious authority, especially in Iran. You can see that's why the marja's in Iran are very heavily funded or silenced if they don't shut up. Because he's completely aware of his lack of credentials. But his main source of threat is Ayatollah Sistani, because he has the credentials, and he's the most influential religious leader, Shia leader, outside of Khamenei, right? But again, given that he advocates for Shia Islam being outside of politics, his influence on politics is very... You can see, like, al-Sadr as a Shia leader is more influential in politics because he's actively involved. He owns an army, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's a statesman.
Yeah, exactly. So even though al-Sadr, unlike his father was a grand Ayatollah, he's not the grand Ayatollah at all, right? You can see that, you know, I might not have the credentials, but look at all these guns and look at all these loyal people to me, right? So again, that's the part. I mean, that's the dynamic. I do remember Sistani and al-Sadr had a conflict a while ago, but then I think that's water under the bridge. I don't know what their relationship is right now.
That was during the war, right? That was like a while ago.
Yeah, that was a while ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So, one last thing before we get to some of the patron questions is so you know that thing I was mentioning in the beginning, that Muqtada al-Sadr does not want political interference of Iran and Iraq's affairs. But at the same time, he has apparently behind the scenes good relationship with Iran. How does that dynamic
and Saudi Arabia? But no, I mean, okay, so he has, so Muqtada al-Sadr has been like shifting positions in the past 20 years a lot, right? And this is what he used to be seen as like a pro-Iranian. Like I thought he was like, before I was many, many years ago, I considered him to be like, oh, he's like buddy buddies with the mullahs in Tehran. But then that's why like it was kind of like, you know, even though after those years, I realized it's more complicated. It was still shocking to see him meet with the Saudis, go to Saudi Arabia. Do you remember that trip with his picture with the Saudis? I was like, what the hell are you doing over there? Like, how is that? I knew that is more complicated. But again, those pictures were still was weird. Like, he does have, he is more getting more and close. So he is playing all angles. Like, he is he's willing to even work with the commies, you know what I mean, like the secularists and the Kurds and the Sunnis. He is very politician-y, you know what I mean. He's not even though he's like a Shia marja, a Shia religious leader, he's not as ideologically strict as some of these other players. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's kind of like, he's a prostitute. He's like an ideological prostitute. Well,
no, I mean, yeah. No, I think, I mean, actually, I think it's a good, I mean, as much as I don't want to, like, be, I think it's a good thing because this will allow all these other players, like the Kurds and the Sunnis and the secularists and all these youth movement, to be able to feel like they might have a seat at the table. Not so much as, by the way, the people who thought it was possible to get like Iraq to have like normal relationship with Israel, I think like you guys are like moving forward a little bit too faster than is possible. Like some people were thinking that maybe with all these Abrahamic Accords and all these people having normalized relationship with Israel, maybe we could get that in Iraq as well. I was like, and the Kurds, the Kurds tried that, and the backlash was so huge. And people are like, nope, not in Iraq, not for a while. So there's that. That would be a major red line for Iran. Oh my God, I can't even imagine. The Kurds, by the way, often work with the Israelis, and they are often demonized because of that. We should see that angle. Oh, by the way, the Kurds had a huge win as well. The Kurds have shifted their strategy ever since their referendum for independence failed, for more autonomy failed. They're now getting more involved in playing the politics, not just regionally, but also in Baghdad. And the establishment powers have shown that they can maintain their influence. It hasn't been... So anyways, I have so much more to say, but
I know there's a lot, but let's go to some of the questions. I think we have three or four. Like, so D Boudreaux, okay. This was the one at 11:08 BMAD. How are you? So she's asking, how many major militias with influence are there?
I mean, I don't know. I have lost count. I think like there's so many, like the last time I looked at it, it was so many different factions and there's so many different flags. I don't know the numbers, but, and also the lines between them is somewhat gray as well. You know what I mean? I think like, yeah, I mean, Kataiba, Hezbollah, Hashb al-Shaabi, I think like you should only focus on the main ones rather than there. Some of them are like, hey, we just, there's two people with a gun. I know, I'm kidding. But no, but there's left and right, like every year there seems to be like new ones popping out or like old ones rebranding themselves. I think like it gets very confusing at some point. I think you should just focus on them main ones and just monitor those or else you're going to lose your mind. Yeah. I don't think you might. Yeah, go
on. So no, then Dee's also asking, and I think you touched on this already. She said, what is the standing of the Kurds? Do they have a political voice now?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. They had the Kurds, the KDP had a major win, right? So I think they're like 1, 2, 3, 4. They got 33 seats. They are above the Fatah. The KDP has more seats than the Fatah that used to be the major power in the parliament in Iraq has now less seats than the Kurdish party, which is they had a strong showing. Okay,
that, and they, think of, yeah, that's true.
That's amazing. That's crazy. That's wild. Yeah.
Okay, and then the final question is: with the group we can't mention making a comeback in Afghanistan, so this is the Islamic State, right? We just call them that. Do you think it could also try for a comeback in Iraq?
No, we're saying it now. I think YouTube is becoming less sensitive about that. It is a threat. I think it is a threat because it's very interesting, Ali, because a lot of the Sunni political parties have become very focused on just playing politics and not having any ground activities because of the constant accusal of them being ISIS. There's this taboo. I think the Sunni groups, the Sunni powers, they are very easily accused of being ISIS if they have any form of ground activity. Okay.
Yeah.
This whole ISIS, you know how it's kind of like, that whole experience with ISIS has been such a nightmare that I think the Sunnis have to like check themselves with regard, like they can't play it too aggressive for a while. They're afraid of the backlash. Like they're trying to they're having their heads down and like they're like, we're gonna play nice, okay? Like we're gonna be good boys and girls, okay? By the way, talking about gals, there were a lot of women involved in this round of like apartments. But anyways, that's another discussion.
One of them was strategic, by the way. I was reading like that Muqtada al-Sadr, like his party did put a woman there to get the women's quota, the vote, and get women out. And so that's how they actually won one of their seats, or probably even more than that.
So. No, I just want to highlight the fact that the talk of ISIS coming back is a constant major discussion, right? Which is having a huge influence on what the Sunni groups get to do or want to be able to see it as them doing. Okay, like so many Sunnis unjustifiably get accused of being ISIS, and this is going to have a major influence for a while. But I would suspect that. I'm so glad to see that this whole young protest movement, you know, is providing a different outlet for people to be upset with their governments, and it having Ali, I just thought about this, you know, because this whole young youth protest movement, which is not religious per se, is making a major difference. Okay, again, it's not like the corruption is going to go away. I'm not suggesting that, but it has. You saw how much the participation. It had a major effect on the participation rate. It brought a new political party to power. So, if these young protest movements are successful, it will provide an alternative to radical groups as a method for new generations to voice their complaints. Do you know what I mean? And given that all these youth groups are very actively anti-Iranian influence, then it makes less of an excuse for new younger people to look at these radical groups as a motivation to attack. You know, it's not anti-Shia, it's anti-Iranian influence, right? And because it's anti-Iranian influence, and the main opposition to that is not Sunnis, it's another Shia party, and also youth groups that are not Sunni or anything else, then it hopefully will make it less motivating for people to join radical Sunni groups like ISIS to counter all of this. So that's a good thing, okay? I would suggest that I think the Fatah group is now hoping ISIS comes back because they're like, hey, you need a because if ISIS comes back, that would be a major win for Iran, because they're like, hey, weren't you tired of us? Don't you need a Shia militia army now again? Like, Do you want us out of your country?
See what happens when you get rid of us. Yeah. Exactly.
See, you always need us. You think that you could just get rid of us once you get rid of ISIS? No. If we go away, ISIS will always come back. So I think that would be their thing that they would really want. This is something, ISIS coming back is something that Iran's government would really, really want to see.
Is the Iraqi government, is it more like that, whatever it's going to look like? Does it have more sort of resources and sort of a military force to be able to fight back ISIS compared to the Taliban in Afghanistan?
That was exactly what I was going to say. I would say, well, it has American-backed and trained army, and we saw how much that was worth.
That doesn't mean anything.
exactly. I just think, like, the Iranian militia have been a lot more successful. I mean, I don't want to dismiss U.S. power, okay? U.S. power from the air in Iraq is like... It just feels like the wrath of God from the people below, right? Like, it just feels like very intense. But when it comes to actually making political difference, the connections that you have, the people that you know, the boots that you have on the ground, the ideological ties that you have, you know, you can't replace those with just like fire from the sky or just advanced military equipment. You know, it has a major influence, like you can't deny that. But at some point, especially when people know you're so far away from home, when your army is so far away from home, there's always this understanding that one day you have to go. And the fact that one day you have to go and people know that makes the dynamic, makes the politics different. Like, we just have to be patient, right? And when it comes to Iranian influence, it's like, bitch, we don't have anywhere to go. This is our neighborhood, right? So even if you are less powerful, you always know that this is your neighbor, and it will always be there. So the fact that one of these forces eventually has to go, and the other will always be there, changes the calculation, right, for people out on the ground.
Yeah. All right. So I guess there's a lot more to go, and maybe we'll do a follow up on this.
If you want to, before you say this, I just want to remind people that who are listening to this, if you're a patron, you could join us live in these discussions and ask your questions live. And if you're a patron, you don't even have to join us live for your questions to get answered. You could basically post your questions, send your questions ahead of time, so for us to answer, even if you're not here live with us. So for future live streams, make sure you check the Patreon link in the description and become a patron so you're involved live with us in the discussion, or to make sure that we answer your questions. So link in the description, consider becoming a patron.
Yeah, and to become, if you want to do that, if you want to become a patron, you can just go patreon.com/SJME.
Link in the description.
The link is in the description, and you can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. You'll get like 5 to 6 live streams like this. You get to join in, you get to watch us, you get to ask questions, you get to participate. And if you can't, as Armin said, you know, you can submit your questions ahead of time on the Patreon page, and those questions will be prioritized and they will be answered first. If you're watching us or listening to us on YouTube, please do hit the like button. You know, if you like what you heard, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button, and hit the bell so you're notified anytime we have more videos and more live streams like this. And other sort of clips. Sometimes we have interesting clips from some of the live streams that we did, and sometimes they're quite entertaining. So you'll get notified about those too. If you're listening to us on your podcast app, you know, Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts or whatever it is, whatever you listen, Stitcher, whatever you listen to us on, please give us a rating, and that will help feature us more prominently on those apps as well. So it'll get out.
Susanna is saying, great show and fantastic form tonight.
Thank you. As always, I learned a lot.
You. Yeah.
Yeah. Armin is a gem when it comes to this stuff. I mean, the kind of things that you're going to hear over here, this is not the kind of stuff that you're hearing in the mainstream media. At least I'm not. You know, I go around and I look at all these articles and I read about it. And so all I have is questions, but then, you just have a really just when it comes to this stuff, especially that region, there's a lot there, that, you know. So I hear I learned a lot, and Susanna's saying the same thing. I think, you know, she learned a lot too. Mars, you're welcome. We will. There's an interesting thing that's happening. I mean, next week. Well, I'll tell you this off the air, but you know, I'm kind of curious about what's happening in Pakistan. So,
My God, yes, thank you.
It's pretty, yeah.
I think we also need to come back to talking about Iraq once there's a coalition.
Yeah.
You know, in a few months, once we figure out how this is going to turn, the results of this election is going to turn out into forming a government. I think we need to revisit Iraq as well.
Yeah, you probably will have to. We'll have to revisit Iraq and Iran.
Pakistan
many times.
What do you think about being bringing Harris Sultan?
I'm going to ask him to come next week.
Okay, yeah, nice.
That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, Pakistan. So, things are changing drastically in Pakistan, so we do need to talk about Pakistan.
Yeah,
it's not in a scary. Good. It's very scary.
All right, guys. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time. Be best.
Oh, wait, one thing. D is saying, please also do a podcast on Ethiopia. We might actually. Things are also escalating in Ethiopia as well, and Sudan as well. So we might have to do podcasts on those. Yeah, best, everyone. Be best.
Take care.
Bye.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends, write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions, or head over to secularjihadists.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you. We'll be right back.